Today on This Week in Iowa, a second special session trying to redraw the legislative lines in our state, then to sit down with the governor, the status of the economy, her visit to the U.S.-Mexico border, and pandemic recovery, the future of our state. All covered this morning. Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for being with us on This Week in Iowa. I'm Sabrina Ahmed. Who's on the ballot for congressional districts will be different the next time you vote for Congress in three of Iowa's four congressional districts. State lawmakers approved the state's redistricting in their special session this week. These maps that we'll see right here in just a moment are set for the next 10 years until the next census. You'll recall the legislature struck down the initial proposal, which would have changed the political landscape of the state quite a bit. This map extends the current political landscape, but will have immediate implications.
If you look at the overall stats of the map, the population deviations did get better. All four congressionals got closer together as far as the population difference. A couple of the districts that we pointed out that looked really weird, that weren't very compact, specifically around Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, it was literally a figure eight around those two cities. That was broken up into different districts, so it didn't have the figure eight. So they really addressed the main concerns that we laid out a month ago.
Okay, so let's start with this third congressional district. It still has Des Moines as the Des Moines area as the big city, but it picks up Wapello County. That's significant because it's the home of Republican Congresswoman Marionette Miller Meeks. She currently represents the second congressional district. Now, Miller Meeks is deciding whether she will run against Congresswoman Cindy Axne, who represents the third district now and will still live in the third district under the new maps, or if she will run in a district where she doesn't live. We've also learned that Representative Ashley Henson will run in the future second congressional district. That leaves the seat in District 1 open because that's where Representative Henson currently represents. I spoke to a political analyst about the implications of these maps.
We are joined now by attorney Gary Dickey with Dickey Campbell Sahag. Gary, thank you so much for being with us again here to talk about redistricting. We did this at the beginning of the month, and now we're here to talk about the second set of maps that were approved by the legislature this time. Talk to me about what this means. What are the political implications? You know, those first maps were really kind of, they kind of blew up the political landscape, and these are kind of business as usual.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on again. Two notable things about the second map is it changes the congressional makeup from one district that was solidly Democratic to three very competitive congressional districts for both parties. And of course, in Northwest Iowa, we have a solid Republican congressional districts. At the local level, what we see is a lot of incumbent representatives and senators thrown into the same district, but that's not unusual. You would expect that there would be some of that every 10 years during the redistricting process.
So does that mean that the next election could really have both the House and Senate maybe up for grabs? Could the Democrats gain some seats here?
There's nothing notable in the makeup of the state Senate and House maps. Iowa as a state has been trending red for the last couple of election cycles. There's nothing that would seem to shake up that balance based on the second map.
The maps now head to the governor's desk for approval. More details are available at weareiowa.com. Now, the governor also has a bill to give employees a way to opt out of employer mandates for COVID vaccines, either health or religious exemptions. This all happened at this week's special session on redistricting. It would also allow people who get fired after refusing to get vaccinated the opportunity to apply for unemployment. During discussion, some lawmakers shared concern on how little time they received to look over the bill. Just 12 hours.
There are some people whose voices have not been included early on, middling, or even later on in this process. Some informed voices, very educated voices.
And this bill, is, I think, is more problematic than it will solve any kind of problems. It will be a burden on the unemployment trust fund. And it's not solving any problem that it's purporting to solve.
Another question posed by lawmakers is, what's the penalty for an employer who doesn't follow this bill? And also, you heard them talk about unemployment trust fund. How much is it going to cost? Ultimately, it did pass both chambers, now moving to the governor's desk. Coming up on This Week in Iowa, I sit down with the governor, from the economy to the pandemic, what she sees for the future of Iowa. Governor Kim Reynolds wants to capitalize on the $1.2 billion surplus our state saw this year. She says there were investments in housing, broadband, workforce in the last legislative session, and she is working to address the child care shortage in the state. Iowa cut income taxes and simplified the tax brackets, and given the surplus, she wants to cut taxes even more.
So let's talk about that $1.2 billion surplus. How do you think that happened? Is it the federal money for COVID relief that came in? What does all of that also mean for the state in the future?
Because it isn't federal money. That's separate. So we kept our economy, we kept our economy open and moving. And because of that, we feed 10% of the nation's food supply is produced by our Iowa farmers. And so we were able to keep that going, and that had a significant impact on our revenues. But in Iowans, there were federal dollars that came into the state. They received funds and then additional funds for childcare and different federal programs. But I think the biggest component of that, honestly, is that when I talk to business and industry, for the most part, some sectors have been hurt significantly, especially our hospitality sector. But for the most part, they're telling me they've had record years the last two years. And so when you contrast that to states that locked down their businesses and closed their businesses, I think that's part of the narrative of why we're doing well and really positioned to continue to grow.
You mentioned corporations are having record profits.
Right.
A report from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy shows that since 2018, corporations are paying dramatically less in taxes. At the same time, employees' compensation is not increasing at the rate of inflation. So is your office seeing corporate tax cuts play out the way you anticipate them?
Well, most of ours wasn't focused on corporate. We didn't actually do a lot with that. We eliminated federal deductibility. We streamlined our tax structure. We went from 9 brackets down to 4. We went from we'll be going from a rate of 8.98 down to 6.5. So this is income tax cuts is where we really focused. In 2018, when we passed the largest income tax cut in the history of our state, we did a 10% across the board cut for working Iowans. And so we reduced the corporate just a little bit, but we've really focused on income tax reductions. But the fact of the matter is we have to be competitive with other states, and every other state across the country is looking at ways that they can be more competitive. And so we're going to look at our entire tax environment and what that looks like going forward. But we are seeing wages increase. I mean, it's because there's a workforce shortage. I mean, I don't talk to any business, small, medium, large, across every sector where they are not screaming for workforce. And so they're being as flexible as they can. They're increasing the wages. They're trying to work with individuals to entice them to come work for their business. And because of that, the market is, we're seeing wage increases across the board. And so, at some point that's going to have to equalize out, but we are seeing wages increase.
60,000 workers across the country, though, are on strike, or a strike is imminent. 10,000 of them, John Deere workers, many of them right here in Iowa. They're on strike because they want higher wages and better environment for where they work.
Right.
And they are not seeing their wages increase to the amount that John Deere is seeing their profitability.
Well, that's
increase.
What the negotiation process is all about, and that's what it was put in place for. That's why they have a union, to sit down with management and to have those conversations. John Deere is a great company. They have a big footprint in the state of Iowa, and they hire a lot of just outstanding workers. And so, that's what makes the company go. That I have complete confidence that the two of the employees and the management will be able to sit down through the negotiations and come to some consensus that will benefit both the employees and the employer.
But don't you think, even if they are federal tax cuts for corporations, that those tax cuts are in part meant to trickle down to employees?
It does. I think we've seen wages go up significantly because there's a worker shortage. And so every single business is vying for that same employee. And part of that process means that they have to increase wages. And I talk to businesses lot of them are starting at $18 an hour now. That's the starting wage. They're looking for opportunities to be flexible with the employees, longer work days, maybe three, work from home, come into the office, hybrid. You know, they're willing to do whatever they can. I don't, you know, we have to be competitive in taxing, in the taxation that we employ, not only on businesses, but on Iowans. And there's a balance, and they hire and employ a lot of Iowans. They have to be successful in order to do that. So it's a balance between all of that to be successful.
Governor Kim Reynolds visited the border at the beginning of October. She visited with a number of other Republican governors as they bashed the president's border policies and announced a list of 10 action items they think are needed to secure the border. When I sat down with the governor, I asked her about her experience and why she went.
Well, first of all, it was a great opportunity for me to sit down. We did a briefing before we actually went and did a tour on the Rio Grande where they patrol the river with the Texas law enforcement. So we had an opportunity to get a briefing from not only the commissioner of the Texas Department of Public Safety, but as well from Governor Abbott and the president of the Border Patrol Association. And it's staggering, the numbers and the data that they are dealing with and the projections of what we're facing. Record number of illegal crossings at the border, a 21-year high. That includes unaccompanied minors, a record high, 1.5 million encounters. And that does not even include the gotaways, which is approximately 400,000. Releasing illegal immigrants and migrants into the states. I actually had the opportunity to tell the story about the 19 young illegal girls, unaccompanied children that were brought into the Des Moines airport in the middle of the night, loaded onto three charter buses and distributed somewhere within the United States. We asked the administration in April about that. It took them over a month before they admitted that they were responsible for doing that. New York Times broke a story this morning about the number of flights that are actually coming in the middle of the night in states all across the country with unaccompanied children and illegal migrants. And, you know, I said they need to be transparent. If there's nothing wrong with it, then do it in the middle of the day. And first and foremost, they should be notifying governors when they're bringing, transporting them into our states. I become responsible for them, and my number one priority is to protect the health and safety of Iowans. And if I don't know when they're coming into my state, that makes it incredibly hard to do that. But not only the number of migrants, I think what was most just so concerning is that just the amount of drugs and human sex trafficking that's taking place at the border, and it's not staying at the border. We're seeing that dispersed to states all across the country. They had a map of the traffic that the cartel moves the drugs and young girls through trafficking through states across the country. And we were a main point of distribution because of Interstate 80 and Interstate 35. And they go from here and then they distribute those drugs and those girls to other states across the country. And it was horrific. They're making $400 million a month moving people across the border. And it's unconscionable. And especially with the increase in meth and fentanyl, you know, to date, and I'm sure this is outdated information by this point, but they had seized 10,500 pounds of fentanyl. 10,500 pounds, that's more than the last 3 years combined. It takes 2 milligrams of fentanyl to be deadly. That's enough to kill 7 times the United States population. And they're very clever the way that they lace pot, and they do it in pills. And so, you know, it's going to start. I mean, it's killing people in states across this country. It's serious, and it has to be stopped. And the fact that they've not even been to the border to talk to the Border Patrol, to talk to the farmers and ranchers, to hear the horrific stories that they're dealing with, to talk to the law enforcement, to just see the numbers that are moving and on their way, I just think it's irresponsible.
Though when you were asked if our state would receive refugees, you said it was not our problem.
No, there's a difference. We can't conflict the two. I mean, this was, first of all, they were children, unaccompanied children, and I said we're not set up to do that. we can't take care. We don't have a foster system. We don't have a facility that has the capacity to handle an additional influx. We're having a hard time, you know, addressing the children that we have. So we didn't have the facilities to do that. When we talk, and these are illegal.
But your words were not our problem.
Yeah, because they're illegal migrants that are being brought across the border. The president could stop that immediately. This is his problem. He unsecured the border. We had a secure border when he took office, and he spent the first month of his administration undoing all of those secure policies that we had put in place. And we see 1.5 million people that have come across that border, a 21-year high, and that includes unaccompanied minors. These children are being transported across the state, and we don't know, they don't even know what happens to them after that. They have no follow-up whatsoever. Now, that's separate than the refugee resettlement that we're working on. There's a process that they go through when they come into the state, like the Afghan refugees. We are working with the refugee resettlement. We're working with our businesses. We're working with our local board of supervisors and communities to make sure that we have some place for them to stay. We can match them up with employers that are, you know, looking for an opportunity to bring them into their facility and to make sure that they have lodging. So those are two completely separate processes that we can't, look at. We can't look at it in the same manner.
As we continue to transition into the next phase of the pandemic, increased vaccinations, open schools, and open state, the governor says it's time to figure out how to move on from the pandemic. Take a listen to our conversation. Talk to me about why you are continuing to fight that instead of allowing for local control.
Because first of all, it doesn't say you can't wear a mask. So what it really does is it puts that decision in the hands of the parents. And I believe that parents are best suited to decide what's best for their children. I don't know their health care of their children. I don't know what they're dealing with. They do, they're pediatricians, they know what impacts their children and what doesn't. And so I'm not saying to parents, you can't wear a mask. I'm saying you're gonna make that decision. We did it safely and responsibly for over a year. You know, we were one of the first states in the country to get our kids back in school. And I believe we need to look at the whole child. It's not just about a mask. It's about the mental and mental health and well-being of the child. It's about the social emotional growth. The number of parents and teachers that came up to me and said, please, please, please stay strong on where you're at with banning mask mandates. Our kids need to be able to see our faces. We need to be able to communicate. That's part of their growth. And then there's also children that have are hearing disabled or have autism or other issues that they're dealing with that really that mask is it impacts their ability to receive the quality of education that they're also entitled to.
There is a woman who is running for school board out of Ankeny who you've endorsed, yeah. Sarah.
Yeah, she's a good friend of mine. And I actually encourage young people all the time to get involved in the running for office, serve public service. And I met her. She was one of the moms that was really frustrated with the lack of information, the changing of
administrators. One might say she led the charge on
that. Yeah, well, her and a lot of parents. She wasn't the only one, but she was very motivated and was really did a good job of networking. That's the word that I want to use. Networking and finding other parents that felt the same way that she did. And that's just how that works. And so I just appreciated her, got to know her, appreciated the fact that she stepped up and made a decision to run for the school board. But, you know, I think this is a grassroots. I think, you know, COVID taught us a lot of things. And one of the things that it taught us was just the importance of local elections. And it really gave parents a front row seat to what was happening in the educational system. And you're seeing parents react. I didn't start this. This started at the grassroots.
But school boards are, they're supposed to be nonpartisan. They're not supposed to have,
this isn't a Republican or Democrat issue.
Well, if you drive through Ankeny or you drive through Waukee, you see vote red for school board.
Decision. But I'm telling you, it's not. I've had parents across the board, and I certainly, Sabrina, didn't ask them, what's your political affiliation, so I can decide where I'm going to weigh in on this issue. I believe parents are best positioned to be in charge of their children's education and health care, not the government. And so she's a friend. I aligned with where she's at, because I do believe that. And so, you know, I said, yes, I'd be happy to support you.
You did say last weekend at your harvest dinner, treat this November like it's next November. So does that say just go to the polls, or are you saying
that says to Iowans? No, it says you have an opportunity to weigh in and help determine what you want this to look like. And as I just said, I think COVID taught us a lot. And one of the things it did teach us is that local elections are important. So if you truly believe as a parent that you should be making those decisions instead of government, then you need to go to the polls and vote. If you don't, you need to go to the polls and vote. I think, you know, our duty as citizens to participate in the election process. And we're always encouraging people to get out there and vote and make their voices heard.
Stay with us. You're watching This Week in Iowa. Thanks for watching, everyone. Thank you to the governor for taking her time to sit down with me this week. Don't forget, we have a podcast. You can find it wherever you find your podcasts. Just search We Are Iowa. Have a great rest of your week, and have a wonderful, happy Halloween.